Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 24th of January, 2013, and today I'm honored to be joined on the line by Gary Chartier, who is a professor of law and business at the La Sierra University. He also is a contributor to the Center for a Stateless Society, where he's a senior fellow. He's also a contributor to Bleeding Heart Libertarians, and he has his own blog at liberallaw.blogspot.com. Gary Chartier, it's great to have you on the program today. Thank you for joining us.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, today I wanted to talk about Lysander Spooner, and as people out there may or may not know, it was just recently his 205th birthday last Saturday on January 19th, which is probably not a date that most people have marked on their calendar, but I understand that you might be something of an expert on the subject, not only because of your background and your education, but also because I understand you have a cat named after Lysander Spooner, so you are uniquely qualified to talk about him. But okay, it's such a huge topic to start talking about the life of such an important thinker, but let's start with the big question. It has been 205 years since Lysander Spooner was born. Obviously he's long dead. Why should we be remembering him at this point? What was his historical legacy?
Well, I'd say that Lysander Spooner deserves continued attention because he was an incisive legal and political thinker and one of the real founders of American individualist anarchism. Spooner was a practicing lawyer who was interested also in kind of big picture constitutional issues that he didn't necessarily ever get to litigate. We'll perhaps talk about that a bit more later, whose increasing realization that the system established by the Constitution was fundamentally flawed led him to move from a kind of radical libertarianism that still took the state with a limited amount of seriousness all the way to a full-blown anarchism, which he articulated in some very passionate and well-argued polemics over the course of his career.
Well, then let's talk a little bit about his life. And of course, it's always a bit, I always get a bit nervous when people start to read too much into someone's biography as that relates to their thinking, because sometimes I think we have a tendency to conflate the two. But certainly, Lysander Spooner did have an interesting upbringing with his father that might have contributed to some of his free-thinking ideas and his libertarian spirit. Let's talk a little bit about his early life and the background that he came from.
Well, you know, there's a lot, obviously, to be said about Spooner's biography. And I guess, indeed, with you, I don't want to draw too much from what we might say about his earliest life. And there may be things you want to highlight there. The two biographical things, I guess, I'd really want to highlight, but I'm very happy to turn to anything that seems more important to you. First of all, something that biographically clearly did play a huge part in his thing has to have been his experience as a competitor with the U.S. Postal Service. Spooner created something called the American Letter Mail Company, which he demonstrated practically was capable of outperforming the Postal Service as a contributor to mail delivery in several major cities. The ultimate result of this was that the U.S. Congress deliberately put him out of business, creating a legislative requirement that made competing with the Postal Service impossible. And of course, we continue to see that today, the legacy there in the Postal Service's limits on first-class mail competition. The other thing in his biography, and again, we can dwell on either of these in more detail, but the other thing in his biography that I'd really want to highlight would be his involvement in the abolitionist cause. And this was not just a matter of framing constitutional arguments against slavery, which he did with great passion, but he actually was involved in some more radical stuff as the crisis involving the prosecution of John Brown continued after Harper's Ferry. Spooner is actually involved in efforts to plan for the kidnapping of the governor of Virginia to trade for the arrested John Brown. So he was very much an on the ground abolitionist activist of a really radical nature, and I think that opposition to slavery was clearly one of the things that led to his own increasing radicalization. But there may be other aspects of his biography you'd want to highlight. But those are
well, in fact, you bring up two of the three main areas of his life and thought that I really wanted to hit on today. So why don't we start with the American Letter Mail Company, and let's set the background for people about where he came up with this idea and why it was so important, and what his success and subsequent, I suppose, failure at the hands of the state really teaches us about what he learned in that experience from trying to go against the state.
Well, Spooner at this point is in the Midwest. This is sometime in the early 1830s. I'm not remembering the exact date, but in any event, he has been involved in a fairly unsuccessful land speculation effort here, and I think he's a young lawyer who's looking for ways to succeed entrepreneurially, and he's able to demonstrate, I think, really successfully that service linking, I believe it's six cities, can dramatically outperform the U.S. Postal Service, and this is a going concern. I think a lot of people will be aware that it is regularly claimed that a functioning postal service is just the sort of thing that we need a state to provide. I mean, it's an odd sort of notion. Postal service is not, in the traditional sense, economic sense, a public good. It's possible to exclude non-payers and certainly to make it go as a market concern. But people often think that somehow we're going to lose out if we don't have a state-driven postal service. And what Spooner did was to show that a clearly profitable alternative to what's often seen as a central state activity could be managed clearly with limited startup capital by a guy without previous experience doing this sort of thing. And obviously this is in part a testimony to his own intelligence and pluck, but it's also got to be a comment on the real possibility of outcompeting the state on its own territory.
And so, of course, what was the natural reaction of that? Of course, the state moved to shut that down and outlaw a competition to show that that in the end, I guess the upstarts will never win.
Exactly. They won't win, not because they're better or not because they're not better, but because they simply can't respond to the state's overwhelming threat of force. And so really a problem. Oh, and, This is typical of the early Spooner. That is, he's interested in taking on the state in its own territory. Perhaps this was the third thing you were thinking of, having to do with bar admission. And as a young lawyer, he worked to make it the case that educational qualifications didn't serve as a barrier to his bar admission. He studied in a law office and then succeeded in meeting bar requirements and convincing the legislature that indeed he shouldn't be ruled out as a candidate because he hadn't met really some fairly arbitrary licensing rules. So he had lots of experience taking on the state in ways that I think made clear to him that there was all sorts of arbitrary sort of regulatory foliage that the state had allowed to grow up around people's exercise of their freedom. And his initial strategies really were ones in which he tried to sort of work within the system. What's clear is that time went on, he wasn't comfortable doing that. But, for a long time, he was apparently optimistic enough about the possibility of making change happen within the system that he kept trying it. And perhaps there's a lesson there that we might return to at some point.
Well, exactly right. As a matter of fact, I wasn't going to bring up his early bar admission fight, but that is actually, I think, a very important part of this early Spooner, as you put it, where he's trying to defy the system, but still to reform the system or amend the system in some way from within. But I think we can see that he definitely departs that in his later years. So let's continue on with that journey. So after the American Letter Mail Company experience, he gets more deeply involved with the abolitionism and activism along those regards. Tell us about his abolitionist views.
Well, so Spooner obviously believes that slavery is a great moral wrong, but he also thinks that it's possible to argue that it's a moral wrong that doesn't involve, that isn't entitled to constitutional protection. So it's ordinarily assumed in this period, both by the friends of slavery and by its foes, that in fact the Constitution is, of course, as William Lloyd Garrison famously said, a compact with hell, precisely because it does enshrine protections for slavery and was designed to keep the Union together at the expense of permitting slavery in those states that that authorized it. And so what's really interesting then about the strategy Spooner adopts is that he thinks that reading the Constitution in the right way can lead us to avoid seeing it as embracing protection for slavery. So he wants to show that slavery really can be seen as inconsistent with the Constitution. And so there's a sense in which he's developed a kind of strategy for reading the Constitution that you might see as, you know, perhaps kind of ironically, given how his thinking develops, as sort of parallel to, say, Ronnie Dworkin's notion of a moral reading of the Constitution, in which there really is an attempt not so much to ignore the surface level textual meaning, but to try to integrate that a reading of the surface level text into a sort of deeper moral picture of where the Constitution might be headed. Now, I think the later Spooner, and certainly later folks influenced by Spooner, would probably be inclined to say that may assume too much about the, quote, moral purpose of the Constitution. Maybe in reality, the Constitution does have the moral flaws that later critics would see built into it, and it's really not the case that we can find in the Constitution a sacred text that has only been ignored or distorted. But what's interesting, at least, is that Spooner tries to make the case that if you put all the relevant passages of the Constitution together, you get a document that that does rule out slavery. And then, as I say, not only is he arguing this on the legal front, but he's also pursuing this as an activist as well.
Well, that's right. And of course, it is ironic or interesting at any rate that he is making that kind of constitutional argument about slavery and abolition, as opposed to, of course, the later Spooner, where who is, of course, most famous for the Constitution of No Authority. So let's talk about some of that, the development of that that thought in Spooner and his eventual complete anarchism, his turning away from the state and constitution. Let's talk about the where those ideas sort of fomented for him, what kind of philosophical ancestors he might have had in that, and really what the reception to those ideas were at the time.
Well, so it seems as if the most kind of natural way to read Spooner, Spooner's intellectual antecedents, is to see him as a, you know, as a kind of radical Lockean, a radical descendant of the intellectual tradition that really is the official doctrine, let's say, surrounding the American Revolution and then later the abolitionist movement. Now, I think the abolitionists are sincere about it. What the, quote, founders really think at a deep level is a more complex question, and I don't know that we can sort that out here. But at any rate, the official doctrine that gets pronounced by the American founders is one that is, as I say, radically Lockean. It's rooted in John Locke's conception that people are self-owners, and that political authority is justified, if at all, only in virtue of the consent of the governed. Locke's own view, of course, is more complicated here, not least because he thinks that while the state, in some sense, requires consent to get going, somehow later generations, while they may be justified in extreme cases in revolting, and this, of course, is the view that the American founders adopt, state authority doesn't require consensual grounding on an ongoing basis. the notion of self-ownership really plays a crucial role, probably not so much in the thought of the founders, but in that of the abolitionists, who see this picture of people as self-owners as fundamentally violated by the notion that some people claim the legal right to own other people. And so they appeal to this fundamental American tradition to identify slavery as something that really ought to be abominated and abolished. But Spooner then is able to extend that notion of self-ownership, to point out that if you take the abolitionist idea of self-ownership seriously, and you think about the conception of consent that's defended by the American founders, what you find out is that it's really an inadequate conception if it doesn't take seriously the fact that ongoing actual consent is required if people aren't to be enslaved, if people aren't to be treated as slaves. And so therefore, Spooner is able to develop and articulate a notion of political authority in accordance with which justified political authority depends not on the majority consent of one's ancestors, but on one's own actual consent. That there are obviously moral requirements that obtain whether one consents to them or not, but political authority doesn't turn out to be valid on a Spoonerian view unless people actually consent to it. And that then provides the basis for Spooner's really passionate tracts in his later life. Not the only thing he writes about by any means, but certainly probably the most enduring stuff.
Well, let's talk about the immediate reception to those works, because certainly Spooner was not known for being particularly diplomatic about his views, and he certainly was known as a free thinker on deism and abolition and all of his various views. Let's talk about the way his work was received during his own lifetime.
Well, it may come as a surprise to some viewers, come listeners, to know that his work did not convert 19th century America to anarchism. It was not the case, unfortunately, that there was a wide-ranging and enthusiastic reception of his denunciation of the Constitution and the American state. However, Spooner did gain a very enthusiastic and committed following in the circle of 19th century American individualist anarchists around and led by Benjamin Tucker. Tucker provided Spooner with a platform in his publication Liberty, and he was very pleased to identify Spooner as a tremendously important figure whose death he really mourned in a very warm obituary. So in that circle, the circle that that arguably began with Josiah Warren, but then really flourished under Tucker's leadership, included people like William B. Green, Voltairine de Cleyre, Dyer Lum. Those folks, obviously not a kind of ideologically cohesive group, but a kind of loose community of American radicals, I think Spooner's thought was kept alive, was embraced, not in its totality, of course. The standard view, I think, in the Tucker circle, for instance, was an anti-intellectual property view, where Spooner held a radically pro-intellectual property view, and that set him apart, certainly in that way, from those folks. But as a general rule, I think his critique of the legitimacy of consent-based justifications for the state was something that those folks were glad to keep alive and to continue transmitting down the years.
Well, then let's talk about that long-term perspective, because obviously I think it's something that that all anarchists of all stripes and persuasions these days can agree on is that Lysander Spooner is an important thinker and someone that a lot of people are still content to look back on as an important philosopher in that regards. But of course, there are these different branches and flavors of anarchism that still war over various philosophical antecedents, etc. So to what extent do you think we can situate Spooner within that matrix, and is it even valuable to do so?
Well, what often happens, and I think we can all be pleased by this, what often happens as the past recedes is that ideological divisions start to seem less pronounced and important than they did when a thinker like Spooner was alive and debating. So I think everybody agrees that Spooner belongs in the camp of the 19th century individualist anarchists, but even people who are perhaps more inclined to identify with the anarchist strand rooted more in Central and Eastern Europe that, you know, roughly speaking, we can talk about as the contemporary social anarchist strand within the broader anarchist movement. I think those folks are quite happy to see Spooner as, you know, a vibrant and important member of the American anarchist tradition. Spooner's IP views, as I noted, are sort of radically propertarian in a way that, you know, certainly other folks who tend to share the Tucker view, and that, of course, includes a lot of contemporary ANCAPs as well as others, wouldn't endorse. But Spooner's overall approach is not typically, I think, going to be dismissed by contemporary social anarchists as a kind of right-wing approach, because it was clear that he was a pro-labor guy. He was somebody who was very interested in helping to ease the burden of kind of debt slavery that people experienced. He had a very radical view about when debt contracts could be enforced and things like that. And so his impulses clearly were not pro-status quo. They weren't pro kind of the economic elites of his time. And because of that, because of his radical anti-slavery views and so forth, even though obviously he's a market anarchist, people in the social anarchist tradition, I think, are even if they disagree with him, going to see him as somebody who's part of the broad anarchist movement. And so he, like Tucker, is somebody from that 19th century world who, despite disagreements about their positions among contemporary anarchists, is going to be a source, I think, of connection between modern market anarchists and modern social anarchists. And I think that's all to the good.
Well, one of the things that I'm hoping that this conversation that we're having right now will motivate some of the listeners to do is to actually start reading some Spooner directly instead of listening to people talk about him. So in that regards, if there are people out there who are maybe starting to dip their toes into the waters of Lake Spooner, what works would you actually recommend for those people, or what do you think they should be concentrating on at this point?
Well, so one real service that Randy Barnett at Georgetown has done has been to create LysanderSpooner.org, which features a lot of Spooner's work, and people can go there and discover Spooner texts for themselves. Many of those texts, of course, are going to be available elsewhere online as well. I believe Liberty Fund's online Library of Liberty features some stuff. So there's a lot to dip into. Also, Cobden Press has begun issuing some Spooner texts, and for instance has recently published a collection of Spooner's work on religion, which is probably some of his more obscure stuff. And my friend Jim Perrin, who is the editor at Cobden, the director at Cobden, has hunted up stuff that really has not been available in the past and cleaned up the text, and not to say he's bowdlerizing it, but that he's ensured that the print edition really directly matches the earlier Spooner text in a way that some online stuff does not. So there's a lot of stuff out there. Much of it's online. You know, some things that people might look at, as you rightly pointed out, the Constitution of No Authority is a pretty decisive argument against consent-based justifications for state authority. I think that continues to be a very live text. The letter to Thomas F. Bayard contains, again, some passionate anti-state polemic. His letter to Grover Cleveland, fairly amusing, I think, if you think about the way in which Cleveland is sometimes lionized by contemporary classical liberals. Spooner will have none of it, and really is very direct in his condemnations there. You know, those are some of the texts that people often quote the most today, and they would be well worth starting with. But I really do encourage people to poke around LysanderSpooner.org and the Online Library of Liberty, where you'll find the text of the one complete biography of Spooner that's available. I'm not remembering the author's name right now, but also many of Spooner's own texts, all there for free. And perhaps Spooner himself would be unhappy about the fact that they're available without copyright protection, but he'd be delighted, I'm sure, that you're reading them.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, I do appreciate your time today, and I should mention that this was made possible through the Center for a Stateless Society, where I got in touch with you via, and as I mentioned at the beginning, you are a senior fellow there. Perhaps we should just talk a little bit about the center and the work that it does.
Well, thank you very much for giving us the chance to talk about that. So c4ss.org is the home online of the Center for a Stateless Society, which is a think tank and media center devoted to developing and promulgating market anarchist ideas. There's a fairly wide diversity of opinion within the market anarchist community, and C4SS tries to be a relatively big tent, though, as people who visited there will know, it's identified specifically with the left-wing market anarchist or left-libertarian approach that I think Spooner and Tucker certainly would have recognized and embraced. C4SS publishes commentaries, which are circulated among newspapers around the world, and gets a limited number of publications in those newspapers in pretty far off places, including Bangladesh, around the world on a weekly basis. It also funds the production of research studies, particularly by Kevin Carson, whose ongoing and enormously productive work is something we're very proud of. But it's home to a number of other people listeners might be aware of, including Roderick Long, Brad Spangler, Charles Johnson, Sheldon Richmond, who's our board chair, Joe Stromberg, a wonderful historian of American radicalism. I'm forgetting lots of people because the number of those associated with the center continues to grow. We've got a number of other projects in play right now that folks might be interested in. For instance, Ross Kenyon and Roderick Long and I are editing a collection of classic and contemporary texts on libertarian class theory, classical liberal class theory. People often suppose that when we talk about class, we've fallen into some kind of Marxist swamp, but the fact is that Marx himself acknowledged that the first systematic thinkers about class were actually some radical classical liberals in 19th century France, Quentin du Noyer particularly, and so we're drawing on those folks and more recent class thinking to point out this the existence of this alternative. We're also working on a collection called Liberation Economics that will be a jointly authored, we hope, a fairly accessible introduction to the kind of thinking, not so much about politics and political theory, but specifically about economics that a number of us are involved in. Plus, we all have our own individual projects that we're working on. So I think it's a pretty fruitful collaboration, and it's an exciting group to be part of.
Absolutely, and I look forward to hopefully highlighting more of the center's work in the future as we go forward. But on the note of the individual projects, if people are interested in following your writing specifically, what's the best place for them to go for that?
Well, so you pointed out that my blog, liberallaw.blogspot.com, is one home for short pieces that I write, as is Bleeding Heart Libertarians. Meanwhile, I've got books that are out and are in the works, the ones that might be of most interest to people listening to this podcast or viewing it would probably be The Conscience of an Anarchist, a book that I hope Spooner would appreciate that I published in 2011, and then Anarchy and Legal Order, which is a more technical academic work that Cambridge University Press released this November. The Conscience of an Anarchist is available from Cobden Press at Free Minds, FR33MINDS, on the web. And the Cambridge University Press book can be obtained from Cambridge or from Amazon. There's also a Laissez-Faire Book Club electronic version of Conscience. You have to join Laissez-Faire Books, of course, to get that, but the print version is available from Cobden. I'd love for people to buy Anarchy and Legal Order, but the hardback edition, which is the only thing that's available right now, is ridiculously expensive, and it may be that waiting for the paperback is the wise thing to do.
Refreshingly honest. All right. Well, Gary Chartier, I really do appreciate your time today, and thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and insight on Lysander Spooner.
It's been a pleasure and a privilege to be here.